Hi, my name is Chris Brennan, and you're listening to the Astrology Podcast. You can find the show at theastrologypodcast.com, and you can also listen to it by subscribing through a podcast app such as Podcast Addict, Stitcher, or iTunes. Today is Thursday, April 30th, 2015, at approximately 5:19 p.m. in Denver, Colorado, and this is the 30th episode of the show. In this episode, I'll be talking with Kenneth Johnson about ancient timing techniques employed by astrologers in the Hellenistic and Indian traditions. For more information about Kenneth's work, see his website at kennethjohnsonastrology.com. Kenneth, welcome back to the show.
Good to be here again, Chris.
Yeah, I think it's been about 2 years now since we had our last discussion, which was about the relationship between Hellenistic and Indian astrology. And I think this is a good sort of follow-up topic to that, which is some of the parallels in the timing techniques that were used in the ancient Hellenistic and Indian traditions, which modern Western astrologers are not as familiar with today, but that are starting to generate a lot of excitement as some of these ancient traditions are being recovered. So the starting point for our discussion, or the focal point for our discussion, is that ancient astrologers had a collection of timing techniques that they worked with that were different than modern techniques. So modern techniques are oftentimes very much focused on real-time events or real-time transits, like transits, for example, which is the position of the planets in the sky relative to where they were in the birth chart. And modern astrologers often have this experience that's very sort of widely, I think, remarked on, that of having the experience of seeing what looks like an important transit come up and having a general idea of what it should mean or how it should affect the person's life or what area of the life, but then it comes and goes and nothing really significant happens, or sometimes it happens in a much different area of the person's life than what the astrologer expected. And one of the things that's interesting, or one of the things that's getting people interested in ancient forms of astrology, is that ancient astrologers actually had an answer to this phenomenon, because they had these collections of techniques known as either time lord systems in the West or dasha systems in the Indian tradition that would tell you which transits would coincide with a hit by telling you which planets were activated in a person's chart at a specific moment in time. So I wanted to use that as sort of the part of our point of departure, and maybe you could talk a little bit about what these timing techniques are like in the Indian tradition, or what got you interested in them and how long you've been working with them.
I've been working with the astrology of India for over 27 years now, and I will not say that timing techniques or planetary periods, as we will probably describe them, I won't say this was what drew me to it. What drew me to that system was a handful of very personal experiences. But I will say that when I first became introduced to the dashas, the planetary periods, it sort of burst upon me like a revelation. In so many metaphysical systems that pass in and out through the New Age world, whether they be older systems like numerology or more recent ones like the destiny cards, we see life divided into a series of planetary periods or cycles. And in astrology, where we would most likely expect to find planetary periods, where we would really anticipate finding one's life segmented into periods of time governed by specific planets, this is where we don't find it. We don't find it in astrology. And as you've pointed out, we rely primarily on real-time events. The transits, the actual movement of planets through the sky as they affect certain areas of our birth chart. Another event-oriented system that I might mention is solar returns, wherein the sun returns to the spot that it occupied when you were born. This is a real-time event. Mm-hmm. Planetary periods are not. In India, they have countless planetary periods, and a lot of the researches that you and others have been doing into the Hellenistic system keep revealing more and more and more levels, and who only knows how many planetary periods we will find by the time the whole of the Greek astrological corpus finally gets translated. There may be many more. In India, there are countless such systems. The best known is the Vimshodari Dasha system, when people speak of a dasha, which by the way means a state of being, a condition of being. When people speak of what dasha are you in, they're usually talking about the Vimshodari, because that is the most common. And there are others, which I hope we'll be able to get into, notably the Kala Chakra. But to go back to this original idea of the interface between planetary periods and transits, it's true that not all transits are regarded as equal in the astrology of India. For example, let us say that the principal time lord of your dasha is the moon, and the secondary time lord is Saturn. Now, maybe 15 years ago, you went through an episode of Saturn making a significant transit to your birth moon, and yet the challenges that you anticipated, that you geared yourself up for, as you say, sometimes they just fail to arrive. They don't happen. However, if a transit involves the two Time Lords, if in fact you were in the planetary period of Saturn and the moon, and then along comes Saturn and bumps into your moon, that's going to be significant. We need to, of course, distinguish between faster-moving planets, slower-moving planets. We can't necessarily get ourselves all filled with excitement at every little thing the moon does, but certainly we could be mindful of slower-moving planets that make transits to the moon, and with Saturn, which is slowly moving, it could go either way, transits to or from. So not all transits are by any means equal. Those that fall within the parameters of the planetary periods, however we define those planetary periods, are by far more effective and more potent than others.
Sure. And one of the things I really like about the way that Indian astrologers describe this theory is that they talk about planetary placements, or the placements in the natal chart, being dormant, or certain placements almost indicating a sort of promise at the moment of the person's birth, but that some of those positions lie dormant until they become awakened as time lords. And it's only at that point, once they've become awakened, that they can actually manifest themselves through things like transits or what have you. And that sort of language has been very useful for me also in reviving some of the Hellenistic methods and sort of conceptualizing what's going on when we're applying some of these ancient timing techniques.
Yes, absolutely. Not every single aspect of our lives, as shown in the totality of the birth chart, not every single aspect of our lives is fully awakened every moment of our lives. There comes a time when certain issues are going to present themselves with more force than others. Now, of course, in Hindu philosophy, this would all be part of the general theory of karma, in the sense that it may be your karma to have a marvelous marriage in life, as shown by the fact that, oh, let's say, for example, you have Jupiter conjunct Venus in the seventh house. And so you think, oh, well, there's a wonderful marriage coming up. But when will it come up? If it comes up when you're 17 years old, let's say you go into your Jupiter-Venus period at the age of 17, you might be one of these individuals who marries their high school sweetheart. On the other hand, let us suppose that the combination of Jupiter and Venus as time lords, if you will, rulers of the planetary periods, let us suppose that this doesn't actually come round until you are in your 50s. So we can see that the unfoldment of karma, to use the Hindu term, I'm not sure precisely what the Hellenistic equivalent would be, whether it would be haimarmene, you know, one's destiny, one's fate, that there is more or less built into the template of our lives that there's a timing for it. So if you received that Jupiter-Venus combination when you were in your 50s, then instead of marrying the high school sweetheart, you're one of these people who perhaps after many ups and downs in relationships in life, finally, when you've reached your maturity and your age of common sense and wisdom, then it happens. So it really is a whole different way of seeing the unfoldment of human life, as opposed to, well, when the transit comes round, any old thing might happen, which is tends to be more the modern perspective. Yeah, there's definitely a framework here. Of course, that brings up certain questions about destiny versus free will. One of the oldest and probably least soluble questions in all of astrology as well.
Sure. Yeah, I think the Hellenistic equivalent definitely would be haimarmene or fate, or the concept of fate, and the idea that, you know, one person might be fated to, you know, meet the love of their life when they're 17 years old versus someone else who's sort of fated to meet, let's say, the love of their life later in life at the age of 50 or what have you. Mm-hmm. And that brings up a really interesting and important point, or it should be obvious how important that would be conceptually and from a technical standpoint, but also just the way that it's sort of pictured, where instead of having these sort of discrete moments where you have a transit and it goes exact, or sometimes it goes retrograde and direct and goes exact two or three times, but nonetheless, they are often conceptualized as like specific dates, or dates within, let's say, an orb of like a few days or a few months or what have you. But the Time Lord systems and the Dasha systems instead are spans of time that can encompass entire decades, sometimes multiple decades, like two or three decades of a person's life, or they can encompass multiple years of a person's life that are under the control of a specific planet, or that activate a specific part of the chart. And this is really important from a technical standpoint. It's much different to conceptualize some part of the chart as being activated for an entire duration of, or an entire, let's say, chapter of a person's life. And that's my favorite conceptual model to use for it, is that what you're doing oftentimes with these Time Lord systems, or the way that it looks when you calculate them and put them on paper, is that you're really dividing a person's entire life up into different chapters and subsections, as if the native's life was a book and you wanted to know where to put the chapter breaks and where to put some of the paragraph breaks, as well as, you know, how to identify where what some of the most important chapters are in a person's life, or what specific topics will become the major focal point of specific chapters, and so on and so forth. Is that kind of would you say that that's kind of conceptually how it's done in the Indian tradition as well, or what's the conceptual model of these sort of spans of time?
I'll take it even farther than that. One of the exercises that I've asked students to do, and this has changed a lot since I began to study Jyotish, the astrology of India. In the old days, when I was in my early 30s and actively teaching contemporary Western astrology, I would sometimes ask people to write an autobiography of themselves which focused on the major transits of the outer planets. And then, after I began teaching Jyotish, I started asking students to write their autobiography as if each dasha was, in fact, a chapter, precisely as you have suggested. And, of course, one interesting thing about Time Lord systems, whether we look at the Hellenistic or at the Hindu, is that sometimes the duration can be quite different. For example, we have the dasha of Venus, which lasts for 20 years, followed by the dasha of the Sun, which lasts only 6 years, followed by the dasha of the Moon, which lasts for 10 years. And quite often I've noticed the same thing happens with at least some of the Hellenistic systems, is that we can have very, very different spans of time for these planetary periods. So some chapters of a human life, if we were writing our autobiography as such, some would be longer and include more material, giving us perhaps more pause for reflection and contemplation. It does put a whole different spin on things, yes.
Okay, and yeah, and part of what you were talking about there, and this goes into another more specific sort of technical part of this approach, which is that when different planets, when specific planets are activated in the person's chart and the natal potential of that planet becomes awakened in the person's life, that the actual condition of that planet becomes extremely important. So if you have a 20-year Venus period, then you have to know what the condition of Venus is in the chart, and if it's well placed in the chart or if it's poorly placed as descriptive of the sort of quality of that period of the native's life and what types of experiences they're going to have during that period and what types of events will occur.
I could give quite an example from someone I know very well. This person's Venus is exalted in Pisces, mm-hmm. and it's in what you would call a kentron in Greek or a kendra in Sanskrit. It's in an angular house, the fourth. So it's at an angle, and it's exalted. And so the 20 years that this person experiences during Venus dasha will be quite different than the 10 years of this individual's moon dasha, because the moon happens to be the ruler of the eighth house, and it's in its last day of waning. So, yes, the conditions of the planets become all important as to the kind of experience that we're likely to have.
Okay. Yeah, there's a similar – a chart example I use is the director Francis Ford Coppola, and he has a similar sort of contrast between some planets in his chart that are extremely well-placed, like Venus being exalted in Pisces in the third house, or Jupiter being in its own sign in Pisces in the third house, or other planets that are not as well-placed. For example, Saturn in the sign of its fall, or depression in Aries in a night chart under the beams of the sun in the fourth house. And the contrast between when one planet was activated as a Time Lord during a certain part of his life and him just experiencing you know, extreme difficulties and doing important work in his life, but just having a very tough time and having sort of an uphill battle just to accomplish what he needed to accomplish during that time period, versus other parts of his life where the planets that were more well situated were activated as Time Lords, and then he received many of the accolades that he got in his life, and things went rather smoothly and rather easily, and they were enjoyable. So sometimes just something as simple as that, of seeing a really well-placed planet in a person's chart in terms of planetary condition, and contrasting that with a really challenging placement, can really be instructive in terms of seeing how these techniques work and seeing the importance of having a technique that can tell you when certain parts of the chart are going to be unlocked or awakened in that way.
Absolutely. And here we can see probably if it were studied, we would see how Coppola had a number of, you know, early successes that were just stunning, and then went through a period where his work was not doing as well at the box office, and critically was poorly reviewed. It's when we look at planetary periods, and in particular when we assess the condition of that planet and how able it is to reach its fulfillment, or to use a more Hellenistic term, you know, how capable it is of accomplishing its business, conducting its business, this is when we really begin to see more clearly than we could see with mere transits alone, the ups and downs that often accompany a human life. For example, in Hindu astrology, it would have been very, very easy to predict certain people coming into fame for unusual reasons at very unusual times. In Vedic astrology, we personify the nodes of the moon in a way that we do not in Western astrology. They become characters with their very definite personalities. And the north node of the moon is sort of a it's a head without a body, so it's wild and it's crazy, and it tends to be very talented, but perhaps fierce and reckless. And people often, because it's also a greedy planet, people often will reach unusual and extraordinary fame during a Rahu period, but for peculiar reasons. One example I could cite is that just before he went into his 19-year Rahu period, Bob Dylan was nothing more than a folk singer in Greenwich Village. He entered Rahu about the time that Joan Baez took him under her wing, and he came out with Blowing in the Wind.
Oh, wow.
Boom. Another one that you would not even imagine is that and this really does show the disparity in ages. Like, for example, Robert Bly had spent most of his life as a gentleman farmer in Minnesota who occasionally wrote poetry. And since he was almost 70 years old by this time, he had been through many transits that had not really made a huge impact on his quiet life. But it was when he entered his Rahu period, when he was close to 70 years old, that he wrote Iron John about the wild man. That's as, you know, north node Rahu as one can possibly get in terms of archetypes. And he's catapulted at a very late age to fame for unusual reasons. So it does really help us to distinguish when these dramatic changes in life are supposed to take place. I know you've been working with a technique in particular called the releasing from fortune and spirit, which includes jumps where the sequence of zodiacal signs will suddenly jump and leap to something completely different. So I'm assuming that these periods of time would also show dramatic changes in the person's life.
Yeah, in zodiac releasing, and that's the primary technique that I sort of have focused on over the past 10 years and that I mm-hmm. teach and sort of use in consultations, there is a part of it that's known as the Vadius Valens, the second century author who's the source of the technique, refers to as the loosing of the bond or the breaking of the sequence. And it can sometimes represent or coincide with a sudden and very drastic career transition in a person's life. One of the best examples is Arnold Schwarzenegger hitting one of these special transition periods in zodiac releasing from spirit in his career periods in 2003, where he had been in one period for 17 years and he'd been a movie star for almost two decades at that point. And then suddenly he hit this transition period, and virtually within the span of a few months, virtually overnight, he suddenly becomes a politician and becomes the governor of California. There's definitely using at least that technique ways to determine major sudden shifts in terms of a person's career and life trajectory. And maybe to back up a little bit, just to give an example. So let's give one example of sort of a really simple, the most simple and widespread Time Lord technique in the Hellenistic tradition was annual perfections. And this is the other major technique that I use pretty regularly and teach. And in the basic method of annual perfections, you just start from, for those who aren't familiar with it, you start from the rising sign or the sign that contains the ascendant in the chart. And you count one sign per year so that whatever sign is the ascendant is located in, the planet that rules that sign becomes activated as a Time Lord for the first year of the person's life. Then when the person gets to their first birthday, once they've completed their first year of life, it moves to the second sign in zodiacal order. So whatever sign follows after the ascendant in zodiacal order, which is always counterclockwise, the ruler of that sign becomes the Time Lord for the year and becomes activated in whatever it signifies in the natal chart. Then after that year is completed, you move to the third sign in zodiacal order, and so on and so forth. So that's a really simple technique, but it's one of those really effective techniques that can be very useful for determining what the quality of an individual year is going to be like, as well as which transits are going to be more important in a given year. So if you're in a Taurus perfection year, for example, and Venus is activated as the Lord of the Year, then you know that any transits to Venus or by Venus that year are going to be much more important than they would be otherwise. So that's an example of a simple Time Lord technique. And then all of the other ones that we've been talking about, like zodiac releasing in the Hellenistic tradition or the Vimshodari Dasha system in the Indian tradition, are somewhat more advanced because they're based on planetary periods, like you were referring to earlier, which are sort of a mixture between actual astronomical periods or cycles that planets have and sort of a symbolic take on some of those periods or cycles, so that it's kind of a blend between actual real-time transits and symbolic sort of thinking. Is that how you describe it? I mean, I'm trying to come up with a decent way to describe that, and I'm not sure if that really fits it perfectly.
Well, I think many of the Western Time Lord systems do have some practical basis. One of the long-standing debates in the astrology of India is just precisely what is the Vimshodari Dasha based on. We have the Sun for 6 years, followed by the Moon for 10, followed by Mars for 7, followed by the north node of the moon for 19 and then Jupiter for 15. As you can see, with the possible exception of the north node of the moon and the 19-year Metonic cycle, none of these planetary periods seem to have any basis in real astronomy, which brings up the whole issue of symbolic systems versus systems that are based on identifiable astronomical phenomena.
Sure, because like all of the planetary periods add up to a specific number, right, or something like that in the Indian system?
They add up to 120. That's what Vim Chowdhury means, yes. In that particular system, they add up to 120. That's true of most. That's true of most of them. But they don't necessarily correspond to the orbital periods of planets or anything that we might really put our finger on in terms of logical timing. I mean, even if we were to take the position that, say, directions are symbolic, still, there's a frame of reference here, is that we're, depending on the different variations, whether it's primary direction, solar arc, Nabod's arc, whatever, we're basically moving everything by 1 degree per year. Mm-hmm. And in secondary progressions, the 28 or 29 day cycle of the moon is expanded into 28 or 29 years. So still, somewhere along the line, we have an actual physical basis that the symbolic systems are based on. But sometimes with some of these Hellenistic systems, and I'm specifically thinking here of the decennials and also the releasing from Fortune and Spirit, it's hard to link these up with anything tangible in the sky.
Sure. And yeah, I mean, with zodiac releasing, it's based on planetary, the minor years of the planets, which are based on synodic cycles largely. So the period associated with Venus and the two Venus ruled signs, which are Taurus and Libra, is 8 years. And that's based on the fact partially that Venus will go retrograde in the same sign or approximately the same spot in the zodiac every 8 years around the same date. And similarly, Mars has a 15-year planetary period, and that's based on the fact that it will also approximately every 15 years go retrograde in approximately the same part of the zodiac. But despite the symbolic nature of the Vimshodari Dasha system, it's still an effective technique, and that's one of the sort of the strange or mysterious things about it, despite sort of the mysteriousness surrounding how they came to those specific periods. You still find it to be useful and effective, right?
Well, it has an interesting history. Your earliest Dasha systems are all based on assessing the strength of a planet. Who's angular? Who's exalted? Who's debilitated? And assigning them in order and assigning the length of their periods based on their strengths. And then the Vimshodari Dasha, which is the one that's primarily used in India today, almost to the exclusion of all others, simply seems to come out of absolute nowhere. It first appears in a text called the Brihat Parashara Hora, and this was put together, no doubt by a number of writers, in the 8th century. And within a few short years, I should also mention that the same text, the Brihat Parashara Hora, introduces almost all of the Dasha systems that are now known to us. It completely overturned all previous Dasha systems and introduced a host of others, of which the Vimshodari rapidly came to predominate over any other Dasha system, and we still have no idea what it's based on at all. Well, we have no idea why these values in time were allotted to it, since they don't correspond to anything astronomical. So that is a mystery. That's one of the major mysteries. And yet, as you've pointed out elsewhere, during the 2012 presidential elections, most of the astrologers in India gave the same prediction, because they were all using the Vimshodari Dasha system.
Right. I was actually really impressed. That was one of the more impressive things when I did a survey of every prediction I could find that was sort of published online or in any of the major astrological journals or magazines, largely in the West. But this included a lot of Indian astrologers or people that were practicing Indian astrology, and just about every single one of them used the Vimshodari Dasha system, which led to a surprising amount of similarity and sort of coherency between different astrologers that were practicing Indian astrology. They were almost all basically on the same page, because they were all using the same technique as their sort of baseline predictive technique. And while some of them would then branch out and incorporate other things like transits or solar returns or other things like that, every one of them ran the Vimshodari Dasha systems for Mitt Romney and for Barack Obama, and almost every single one of them, except for one guy, concluded just based on that Obama would win, because the planetary placements that were being activated in his natal chart, according to this Dasha system, were activating very strong and very sort of successful parts of his chart at that time, indicating that he would win. And there's just something very interesting about that, about the fact that you have this single powerful timing technique that's used by every astrologer virtually in a specific tradition, leading to greater consistency or coherency between, you know, an entire tradition of astrologers that are all practicing that form of astrology just because they're all using the same technique. There's something interesting about that.
Yeah, and I would say that it does lead to a stronger consensus. Typically in Western astrology, when we have an election, typically what we're studying, we place our greatest emphasis on the transits to the candidate's birth chart, perhaps using subsidiary techniques that are among our favorites, whether they be secondary progressions, solar returns, or whatever. And this can lead to a lot of wide variation, to many people making very different kinds of predictions. Whereas if everybody is using the Vimshodari Dasha, then they all agree on, you know, what planetary periods Obama would be in. They all agree that transits to those planets are going to be the most important one, and they're all making a vast distinction between, say, a planet which is debilitated and a planet which is powerful because it's in its own sign. So, yeah, it's hard to get around these basics. It's hard to try to argue against what appears to be just a very straightforward kind of matter. And it does lead to a lot more consistency in that respect.
Sure. Yeah, and it'll be interesting to see in the future, as more of these sort of Western Time Lord techniques are rediscovered, and as they become more integrated into contemporary astrological practice, if you'll start to see greater consistency in some Western astrologers' predictions. If you know, several astrologers are all using zodiac releasing, for example, as me and my friend Patrick Watson, or my friend Patrick Watson and I did during the 2012 election, to make our prediction about at least at the time, we predicted Obama would win based on the zodiac releasing technique, because the zodiac releasing technique is effective in showing peak periods in a person's career and reputation. It'll be interesting to see if there's greater, more of a consensus amongst Western astrologers in the future as some of these advanced Time Lord techniques become standardized.
Yeah, and that's an interesting question for the future. Initially, if we look back to Hellenistic astrology, and if we look back to the first few centuries of the Common Era, when that form of astrology was introduced into India, we do find that the emphasis is on Time Lord systems, planetary periods. And, of course, India, being the highly conservative civilization that it is, has never changed. In India, your planetary periods, your dasha systems, are still the primary method of assessing future trends, whereas everything else from solar returns to transits is definitely secondary. And yet somewhere, somehow, the Western world lost all of this. And what has always sort of boggled my mind, since it seems so essential to the very concept of astrology itself, is that our lives, you know, the idea that our lives are made up of chapters which could be entitled according to the different planetary periods, it seems so quintessential to the very concept of astrology that I wonder how we ever lost this.
Right. Yeah, I really have no idea either, other than that, you know, some of the texts in the West that contained these systems, like the text of Vedius Valens, for example, just never got translated. We had texts like Ptolemy, but Ptolemy doesn't really, he only pays lip service very briefly to like one or two Time Lord systems, one of which is just primary directions, which is more of a directive technique. And he very briefly alludes to annual perfections, and that's pretty much it. So we kind of lost, due to the loss of, you know, the ability to read Greek amongst sort of normal astrologers, we lost the ability to read those texts, and we also just didn't have access to them until the past couple of decades. And now all of a sudden, we're reading those texts again, we have access to them, and we're finding all of these timing techniques that we didn't know we had lost that were extremely important. So part of that, though, and that raises an interesting point, which is that because Indian astrologers have been using these systems continuously for the past 2,000 years, it's actually interesting that Western astrologers have a lot we could learn, a lot that Western astrologers could learn a lot from Indian astrologers about how to use the Time Lord systems that we're rediscovering right now, because in many instances, the application is very similar, but there will sometimes be little tips or little sort of variations of the technique that Indian astrologers use that are actually very useful and very applicable within the context of the Hellenistic Time Lord systems. And I've already learned a lot from just studying how Indian astrologers apply the dasha systems that I found to be very useful in rediscovering how to apply the Hellenistic Time Lord systems in modern practice.
Yeah, I really do think that we have preserved a lot, and a lot of it comes from oral tradition. It wasn't even necessarily written down all the time. For example, when we are working with a major Time Lord rather than a secondary Time Lord, then in a sense we're seeing the whole chart as if that Time Lord had become a secondary ascendant, or a temporary ascendant. Also, when we look at Time Lords, we would say that the major, let's say you're in a period of major period of Moon, minor period of Jupiter, then the Moon forms the background of this time period, but the daily events and circumstances are more likely to be ruled by Jupiter. All of this is stuff that we seem to have simply retained because of the conservatism of the culture over centuries and centuries, in the sense that no one can really tell where all of these ways of reading the Time Lords has originated. And it could be presumed that we could at least experiment with reading Hellenistic Time Lords the same way, because one of the things that I noticed when I began to read the Hellenistic material is we get a whole lot of theory, but with the exception of, I guess it was Antigonus of Nicaea, who gives us several fairly well worked out horoscopes of several pages each, but doesn't really consider the Time Lord systems. And then Vettius Valens gives us many illustrations, but sometimes they're maddeningly short, like only a few sentences.
Right.
So we don't really have a complete rundown on how all of this was supposed to be employed, how all of it was supposed to be used. And I think in that sense, an open dialogue between India and the West would be very fruitful as we begin to reclaim some of these Time Lord systems from the Hellenistic period of time. Some of them actually are closer than we would imagine. For example, as I mentioned, the Brihat Parashara Hora gave us most of the Time Lord or Dasha systems that we use today, including the most popular, which is the Vimshodari. But the writers themselves say that the Kala Chakra Dasha was the finest and most splendid. Now, in this Dasha system, we have two beginning points. One is called Deha, which is a sign that represents the human body and everything that happens to it. And then we have the Jiva, which is one of many Sanskrit words for soul, but more relates to the fiery, vital energy that drives the soul. And we can start from either point, and we proceed with the signs of the zodiac, and the planetary ruler of the time is whichever planet rules that sign. And then bingo, all of a sudden we have what we call a gati, which is a leap that goes from one sign to a completely different sequence of signs. So obviously this is the releasing from fortune and spirit.
Right. So that's
in almost all its essentials, with the Deha taking the part of the moon or fortune and Jiva being the part of the sun or daemon. So it tells us, for one thing, that probably a little bit more than simply Ptolemy was preserved. I'm going to do a paper on this at some period, but virtually the simplest explanation is that writers in the very northwest of India, where Pahlavi was a well-known language along the Silk Road, must have been reading the Pahlavi version of Vettius Valens.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
We don't need to go to wild lengths as to why they were able to find this system. But I think you're absolutely correct when you say that the majority of astrologers who reclaimed Hellenistic astrology during the early Islamic period, they were relying mostly on Ptolemy, which is why we end up with, you know, if you go to the early Arabic astrologers like Masha'Allah and Abu Mashar, you're basically ending up with directions, primary directions, and perfections, which, as you stated, are the two that we got from Ptolemy.
Sure. Yeah. And I mean, even they had things like Fridaria, for example, which appears to be a Persian Time Lord technique. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure, I mean, they did have access to other texts. They had, you know, parts of Valens, and they had Retorius and a few other authors. But it's really later in the tradition that, sort of as the tradition goes on, we see any reference to most of these Time Lord systems completely dropping out in the West. And finally, the only one that kind of survives is Annual Perfections, which is referenced, I think, in William Lilly. But then by the time of most of the 20th century authors, it's just this completely forgotten technique, despite it being so simple, where you just find the rising sign and that sign gets activated. And then the next year, the next sign gets activated and so on and so forth.
Oh, yeah. It's definitely the simplest of all the techniques. And in many ways, I've also... when working with Western astrology, I found it also to be among the most valuable. And my own personal feeling from talking to the Hellenists is that certain Time Lord techniques are capturing your imaginations, whereas others maybe not so much so. In fact, Firmicus describes decennials as being a very common technique, but I haven't met any of the Hellenistic students who are actively working with decennials, whereas the releasing from fortune and spirit has clearly captured the imagination and enthusiasm of most Hellenistic students. I think we're going to see a lot more from the releasing from fortune and spirit in times to come, and perfections are so simple and so quintessential that I would expect to see more use of perfections in the near future as well.
Sure. Yeah, and I think there are several other Time Lord systems in the Hellenistic tradition that just haven't been explored that much or don't seem as impressive as Zodiac releasing or perfections so far, although it'll still be interesting to see if anybody does decide to pick those up and really work them out and how to use them and demonstrates how that they can be used just as effectively as Zodiac releasing or what have you. You referenced decennials, which is mentioned by Firmicus Maternus and Hephaestio, and I think Valens as well. And then one other one that's actually being used now is circumambulations through the bounds or primary directions through the bounds, and using that as a type of Time Lord system by activating the rulers of the bounds in the number of degrees that the planet rules for a certain number of years or a certain amount of time. That's something that Benjamin Dykes and Dimitri George have both given presentations on recently that have been very impressive on how to use that as a Time Lord system.
It was actually Dimitri who taught me how to do it. And of the various Hellenistic techniques that I've experimented with, I have found this to be one of the most fascinating. You're going to come up with what we would call dashas of roughly, you know, maybe as long as, what, 7 or 8 years, maybe as short as 5. Mm-hmm. But it's a nice chunk of time that can be worked with. And trying to write my own autobiography seen in terms of the Lords of the Bounds during circumambulation, just as we talked about writing our autobiography with transits or other Time Lord periods, this has been very helpful to me. I would really like to see more people working with circumambulation of the bounds.
Yeah, and I definitely think we'll see that. And I think, you know, so far there's been a lot of enthusiasm from people like myself and others around techniques like Zodiac releasing, just because it was so different, but also so impressive because it did things that we didn't know that you could do with astrology, like identifying, you know, when a person would hit the high point of their career or when a person would, you know, get in a relationship that would last for 3 decades of their life or get in the most important relationship of their life or what have you. Like, it's like that, those types of techniques didn't really exist in modern Western astrology. And now that we're reviving them, there's a lot of excitement around that, but there's also a lot of, there's some things that we have to work out. There's a bunch of philosophical issues that these techniques are raising, partially largely derived from the fact that almost every single one of them you can calculate just based on the birth chart from the moment of birth. And the problem with that, philosophically speaking, is that you then have basically an outline of all of the planetary periods and all of the chapters of a person's life are clearly set in place from the moment of birth. And oftentimes the prediction that you would make based on looking at those periods about different parts of the person's life, you would basically make the same interpretations when a person was 5 years old as you would say when a person was 30 years old, to the extent that you know what planets are going to be activated at specific parts of the person's life, and therefore when certain things are supposed to happen. And there's something a little bit eerie or a little bit philosophically unsettling about that sometimes to many Western people, because it appears to imply that things are more predetermined than we originally thought.
It certainly does raise the age-old question, which is, beleaguered astrology for centuries now, as to the degree of free will and the degree of predestination which goes with us all. And I agree. It does raise a lot of questions. And yes, even though I think that practitioners of Jyotish who grew up here in the United States and started out with Western astrology, we would be very, very careful about saying, well, let's see, you've got a debilitated planet coming into play when you're in your late 60s. And boy, you know, when a planet that's that difficult comes up, you know, when you're getting along in life, unlikely that you're going to get through that one. When we make these kinds of predictions, and you're right, you could look at the chart of a five-year-old and you could see this, right?
Right.
It does sort of make everything sound predetermined. The astrologers with a philosophical bent of mind really need to take a hard look at how much freedom of will do we have to shape the experiences within the boundaries of, okay, I'm running the period of a debilitated Saturn right now. I can expect these challenges. You know, it's in my ninth house, so I can expect this. Maybe then we have to look at how important our response to those challenges is if we want to keep reclaiming reaffirming our free will through all of this.
Sure. And I guess at least in India, you know, because you have the backdrop of some of the philosophical and religious concepts of Hinduism and belief in karma and things like that, there's already sort of like a spiritual or sort of religious backdrop with which to couch the astrology, so that some of these ideas about things being perhaps somewhat more predetermined than a normal Westerner that you pick up off the street might think, you know, maybe isn't as sort of crazy of an idea, or doesn't strike people sort of the wrong way necessarily culturally, but I guess it's when you're reviving some of these techniques in a Western context that I think you can sort of maybe startle people, or that it appears a little bit startling from that standpoint, just because maybe we're not used to thinking about life in that way in a sort of philosophical or religious context as being that much more predetermined than we might expect.
Right. Although even in India, they do feel that certain amounts of your karma are predetermined, whereas other facets of karma we make for ourselves, and it's pretty much too late in the discussion to get into a whole philosophical background on that, but it is taken into account. There is much more of a juggling act between destiny and free will than one might imagine at first glance, but that may be for another time.
Sure. Yeah. And that's certainly the case, even in the Hellenistic tradition as well, where there's sort of a spectrum. So the last point to touch upon was just something that you already raised, which is that some of the sort of ethical and practical issues that come up in applying these techniques in modern practice with modern Western clients, and, you know, what you say and what's appropriate to say and what perhaps you shouldn't say or what should be held back when you're doing this type of predictive astrology, is a whole area that I think Western astrologers are largely not have not had to wrestle with at this point. But now it becomes like a major issue where some sort of like guidelines have to be made, or at least astrologers are starting to struggle with some of these issues because they're coming up within the context of using techniques like this. So that's another area probably where many of the practitioners of Indian astrology and the people, Westerners that have studied in Indian astrology would probably have a lot to say that would be helpful and sort of instructive, because you've already done a lot of that work.
Oh, well, we had a wild time of it at the beginning, back in the 1990s when we first started holding conferences. We would bring senior astrologers over from India, and they would just start, they would sit down with Western clients who were completely unfamiliar with the Indian system, and they would say things like, well, you know, judging from the dasha and the sub-dasha period, it looks like your father's going to die next week. And then we would have to take him next year, and we would have to take them aside, and we would have to explain to them, look, you know, you're in a different culture. We just don't do this here.
Right.
We just don't. And then we would have to look at ourselves, and we would look at the chart, and we would look at ourselves and says, well, it does kind of imply that, doesn't it? And then we would have to, you know, look back through all our psychology classes that we'd taken in college. And I think it's an ongoing process. I don't think we've anywhere near reached the end of it. We're still re-envisioning this ancient art in a way that makes sense and harmonizes with a culture that is more strongly founded in free will, and a culture where it is totally inappropriate for counselors to make off-the-wall statements like that.
Sure. And it's just really interesting how you guys, how sort of Westerners using Indian astrology and how that movement started in the 1980s and 90s, how you guys have probably a 20, almost 30 year head start on the traditional Western astrology movement, which I feel like is just now in the past 5 or 10 years really starting to gain a lot of steam and see a lot of practitioners and a lot of movement and energy in that direction. Now we have a lot of catching up to do, but it'll be interesting to have some of those discussions and some of those exchanges in the future, since, there's a lot about it, because there's even a spectrum amongst Western astrologers at this point where sometimes you do have, you know, the more people doing traditional astrology that feel like they just give it to the person straight and that there shouldn't be any filters or any necessarily restraint. Like, like Robert Zoller, for example, is somebody that's sort of widely reputed to be somebody that really, you know, delineated the chart and gave it to people straight, even if that was not pretty, or even if there were things that were said that, you know, a psychological astrologer would think was just totally inappropriate for them to just throw out there in the context of a consultation.
Right,
And sort of you have that sort of spectrum even amongst Western traditional astrologers now, where there's this kind of debate that's happening or still needs to happen about what's appropriate and what's not appropriate and so on and so forth. So anyway, I think that brings us towards the end of our discussion. So you personally, I mean, we've been talking about a lot of specific Time Lord and Dasha systems, but you regularly apply some of these Dasha systems in practice in your consultations, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like everyone else, I was founded in the Vimshodari, which is common everywhere, but I also have been doing a lot of experimentation with the Kala Chakra Dasha, for one thing because almost no one else does, and also because of its clear links with the releasing from fortune and spirit, and the sort of cross-cultural outlook and view that this implies. I've been working a lot with the Kala Chakra Dasha system and a few other things in terms of solar returns. We do have a Hindu form of solar returns. I use quite a number of techniques, yes.
Okay. Well, yeah, and I think your familiarity, I mean, I always appreciate having these discussions with you because your familiarity with both having a deep understanding of Indian astrology, but also being very intimately familiar with Western astrology, including many of the ancient traditions like Hellenistic and medieval astrology, I think puts you in a unique and really great position to be somebody to talk to about or sort of have a consultation with to go over some of those things, because you're able to sort of converse with in both realms and have discussions using the technical terminology of all of the different schools.
Well, thank you. I mean, I was as thrilled as anybody when the first Hellenistic texts began to be translated and to be more available. It was a big thrill for me too. You know, just another part of my astrological awakening.
Sure. All right. Well, yeah, I look forward to the future. We'll have to have you on again to discuss, maybe go into the details of the Kala Chakra system and see what you're finding in it and compare that to some of the work that I'm doing with Zodiac Releasing.
Excellent.
All right. Excellent. And what's your website again?
KennethJohnsonAstrology.com.
All right. Excellent. All right. Well, thanks for coming on the show. I guess that does it for this episode. So thanks, everyone, for listening, and we'll see you next time.